Good morning, everyone. The Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will now come to order. Amira, please call the roll.
Chair Plakin.
Here.
Vice Chair Caruso.
Here.
Ranking Member Gottlieb is excused. Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Benjamin.
Here.
Byrd.
Here.
Davis.
Here.
DeSegli.
Here.
Fernandez Barquin.
Here.
Garrison.
Here.
Gregory.
Here.
Learned.
Here.
Mello.
Here.
Rayner.
Here.
Sabatini.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. As a reminder, make sure all electronic devices are off or turned to silent. Today, we're going to have three presentations on the agenda. We'll start by hearing from Chris Spencer, the Director of the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget, on the budget recommendations of the Governor for fiscal year 2021 and 2022. After that's concluded, we'll hear a brief presentation from Secretary Mark Inch with the Florida Department of Corrections relating to the 8.5-hour shift transition implementation and its progress, followed by a brief presentation from Secretary Simone Marsteller with the Department of Juvenile Justice relating to the residential commitment resource utilization. Right after each presentation, we'll have a few moments for questions from members. We'll go ahead and get started. Mr. Spencer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Mr. Chairman, it is my privilege to present the Florida Leads Public Safety Budget Recommendations by Governor Ron DeSantis for fiscal year 21-22. And joining me today are two of our best agency heads, Secretary Mark Inch of the Department of Corrections and Secretary Simone Marsteller of the Department of Juvenile Justice. There are seven agencies represented in the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget Public Safety Unit. Those are the Department of Corrections, the Department of Juvenile Justice, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Department of Legal Affairs, the Florida Commission on Offender Review, the Justice Administration, and state courts system. The Governor's Florida Leads budget totals $96.6 billion. This chart presents an overall picture of the budget by policy area, first all funds, and then general revenue specifically. The public safety portion of the overall budget is $5.8 billion, which represents 6% of the budget. This is a 3% increase over the current fiscal year's public safety budget of approximately $189.3 million increase. Of the total budget, $35.8 billion is general revenue. Public safety represents 13.6% of the general revenue budget with almost $4.9 billion, and this is a 2% increase of $95.7 million in general revenue funds over the current fiscal year. Governor DeSantis has made public safety a top priority and has taken bold steps to protect all Floridians. $2.9 billion, or half of the $5.8 billion Florida Leads public safety budget, goes to the Department of Corrections. This represents a $72.4 million increase over the current fiscal year. The second largest portion of the public safety budget is the Justice Administration, with $1 billion in funding to support Florida state attorneys and public defenders. Secretary Inch will present the highlights of the Governor's Florida Leads budget recommendations for the Department of Corrections, and Secretary Marsteller will present the highlights of the Governor's Department of Juvenile Justice budget. So I'll hand it over now to Secretary Inch.
Secretary Inch, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Plakin and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on behalf of the 30,000 men and women of the Florida Department of Corrections, the nearly 80,000 inmates currently remanded to our custody, and the 145,000 offenders we supervise in a community setting. I first want to thank Governor DeSantis for putting public safety at the forefront of the state's priorities through the fiscal year 2021-22 Florida Leads budget. Governor DeSantis' budget recommendations continue to set FDC on a positive trajectory as we strategically work to improve our system. The governor's demonstrated support recognizes our needs and the critical public safety role we provide for Floridians. The FDC items in the governor's budget request represent the second year of a multi-year effort to address what had become and remains a correction system in crisis. Some of you may remember from last session me holding up a copy of the Devil's Butcher Shop. In order to avert the risk either of such a catastrophic event as the prison riot that book outlines, or of an equally injurious legal or judicial outcome, we've laid out a comprehensive multi-year strategy that reduces the risk to the liability of the state to a satisfactory level. That strategy is laid out in our strategic plan and annual report to be published soon. The items laid out on the slide before you represent the most important FDC items in Governor DeSantis's Florida Leads budget recommendations. These are important milestones along a multi-year strategic effort. Let's go through each one briefly. Line one, staff retention for correctional employees. The most important near-term objective in our plan is to reduce staff vacancy and attrition. Because of staff attrition rates, the department is facing an ongoing and severe shortage of correctional officers. This shortage has reached crisis levels, resulting in an inability to fully provide the safety and security due to the inmates in our custody, placing the liability of the state at severe risk. In FY1920, FTC exceeded 500,000 hours where critical security posts were unmanned because there was simply not a correctional officer available to man them. Staff attrition and vacancies are the results of three issues: the environment or our working conditions, pay, and a lack of timely training for new correctional officers. The $31.1 million on the first line addresses two of these issues. As you know, the department has experienced numerous issues directly related to the 12-hour shifts currently in place, including increases in separations of staff, use of force incidents, contraband, and violence incidents. Last year, with your investment, we converted 17 of our institutions to an 8.5-hour shift. We have already seen an improvement in critical post coverage. This year, the governor is requesting the necessary FTE and funding to convert approximately half of our remaining facilities to the 8.5-hour shift schedule. I cannot overemphasize how critical moving to 8.5-hour shifts is over this 3-year period. It is the single most important thing we can do. Additionally, approximately $4.9 million of the $31 million is invested towards a targeted retention pay step plan. This recommendation follows last year's good work and continues the investment for new hires by providing a 500 pay annual increase for new hires, 1,000 pay increase at 2 years of service, and $1,000 increase at 5 years of service. Line two, safer correctional facilities. This budget request addresses the second objective in our strategic plan, specifically reducing inmate violence, idleness, and addiction. The $2.5 million will go to two efforts. Approximately $461,000 will go to funding a security threat group sergeant in 7 more of our institutions. Since the implementation of the 34 dedicated SDG sergeant positions that were funded last year, staff have been able to identify and document critical incidents related to the growing SDG population. The officers provide valuable information impacting the safety and security of their facilities. With these dedicated positions, previously specially assigned positions were able to return to their assigned shifts, thereby reducing critical vacancies. The remaining $2 million on this line go to purchase, replace, and upgrade critical security enhancement equipment, such as netting systems for throwovers, yard radios, security system upgrades, and quite a long list added to that. Line three, academic and vocational programming. The $1.5 million here is focused on two synergistic objectives. First, reducing inmate violence, idleness, and addiction, and second, providing positive choices. Something that is true of any group of people confined in a relatively small area for an extended periods of time, such as our inmate population, is that idleness leads to, well, suboptimal choices. Programming offers inmates the chance to be busy in a positive ways, in ways that will help provide them the skills to make better choices both while in custody and once back in the community. It also happens to be the single best solution to preventing them from being busy in counterproductive and even dangerous ways. FTC is committed to expanding reentry programming, both vocational and academic. The $1 million in this request would go towards career and technical services education expansion. This recommendation will increase the number of vocational and industrial certificates that are earned and help inmates return to their communities with the entry-level job skills needed to productively contribute to Florida's communities. $461,000 of the and 7 FTE expand much-needed academic programs statewide. Personnel reductions in past years resulted in major institutions without adequate teaching staff to administer program and testing in literacy programs. For every literacy grade level increase by an inmate, their likelihood to return to prison decreases by 4%. And again, the average reading level of an inmate coming in is sixth grade. Line four, maintenance and repair. This $14 million directly addresses the fifth objective of our strategic plan, addressing aging infrastructure, specifically fixed capital outlay dollars focused on critical repair and renovation of facilities statewide, environmental deficiencies, ADA requirements, and security enhancements. The department is responsible for the repair and renovation of 145 facilities statewide, which equates to more than 20 million square feet of space. We have more space than any other agency in the state. As many as you have seen during your visits to our institutions, this funding is vitally important. And with that, Chairman Plakin and members, I thank you for having me here today. I look forward to continuing to work with you during this session to support our public safety mission. I am prepared to give the briefing on the 8.5-hour shifts, or we can do that in sequence after Secretary Marsteller.
We'll go ahead and move to Secretary Marsteller. You're recognized.
Thank you and good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, committee members. I am Simone Marsteller. I am the Secretary of the Department of Juvenile Justice, and it is my pleasure and honor to present to you Governor DeSantis's the highlights of his recommended budget relative to the Department of Justice. I've been at DJJ now for 2 years, and in that time, I've developed a really strong and great appreciation for the work that our staff, you know, agency staff and contracted staff, the work that they do around the state to ensure public safety. That is the primary, that is the mission of the Department of Juvenile Justice, is to ensure public safety. And people, my people work very hard at that. Going into this session, the department's priority is to remain committed to data-driven and reform-minded efforts while keeping public safety at the forefront of all we do. Florida's juvenile justice system is one of the best in the country, and it's one of the largest, if not the largest. And we, along with our partners, strive to continue building a balanced and sustainable system, one that recognizes that if we reach kids early, we have a much better chance of turning their lives around. Governor DeSantis's recommended budget supports fully the mission of the Department of Juvenile Justice. He is, as I'm sure you all know, very public safety minded, and he continues to support us in our policy and our budget needs, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. So in Governor DeSantis's recommended budget, the major issues funded are on the screen in front of you. The first one is for us to reprocure the department's detention services healthcare contract. In March of 2020, the provider that we had at the time, Maxim Health Services, ended its contract with the department early because the company felt it was not making enough money. So we had to issue an emergency procurement to get another contractor in. We were lucky enough to be able to get a contractor to come in and do the services within the current budget that we had. But through the process of doing the emergency procurement, we did reach out to several companies for quotes. And on average, those companies came back with quotes that were $4.5 million more than the resources that the agency had, which is why you see the $4.5 million priority item here in the governor's recommended budget. We know, based on our research, that healthcare costs are rising. We want to make sure that in our detention centers, we have the right amount and type of staff, mental health, nurses, LPNs, administrative staff, we want to make sure that our kids are covered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's our responsibility. We also, though, in re-procuring this contract, we are going to include, to the extent that we can, telehealth, which we know is something that is has proven itself during this COVID situation to be a very useful tool. But in our detention centers, it can be particularly useful. It can be a time and cost saving, so it allows a physician to assess a youth and prevent the need from having to send a kid out to the hospital to get assessed there. That always requires for us to send two staff with the child to the healthcare facility, which means then we have to move around staff inside the facility to make sure we have coverage. This is a priority issue for the Department of Juvenile Justice, and the governor understands and supports us in that, and I am grateful for his support on this particular issue. The next item on the list, priority item, is for electronic monitoring for youth. We at the department are responsible for overseeing youth who are in the community, for example, particularly as an alternative to being in secure detention in a detention center. We have found that we need to not only upgrade the technology that we're using, we have had to replace and spend quite a bit of money to replace units as they go bad. That has not been part of the current contract we have. And so we know that we need to upgrade and have a contract that covers all of those things, that increases the number of units, but also increases and brings us up to date with the technology that we're using. This will include improved data analytic tools to monitor youth, which will allow the department to track patterns and better assess potential risk. It would include more reliable hardware, battery technology, and 100% coverage on all lost or damaged equipment. We do plan to increase, again, the number of electronic monitoring units to meet the increased demand. And again, this is something that is good for the youth. It allows us to offer a more expanded alternative to secure detention so that these children can, yes, remain in the community, albeit supervised, but this is a very good thing. And once again, I appreciate Governor DeSantis's support on this issue. The third item on the list of our major issues is money for maintenance of our facilities. We have approximately 50% of our buildings across the state are more than 25 years old. They are in use 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. These are major facilities that the state owns and operates. So this funding is necessary not only for minor repairs, but for major repairs including fencing, lock replacements, doors, master controls, closed circuit television repairs, upgrades to windows, and all of these things at the end of the day are required to make sure that our children are safe and healthy in our facilities. Those are the three major issues that the governor is recommending to be funded in his budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Once again, I am grateful to Governor DeSantis for his support of this department and his support of our mission.
Thank you. Mr. Spencer? You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me go to my tab here. And thank you, Secretary Inch and Secretary Mosteller. The governor's Florida LEADS budget also invests $14.5 million to continue the transition to incident-based crime reporting and to centralize criminal justice data and make it more transparent to the public. The governor's budget also provides the Florida Department of Law Enforcement with funding to replace critical law enforcement radios. FDLE currently maintains over 2,000 radios on the state law enforcement radio system. And additionally, FDLE maintains radios in each region and at headquarters that are used during joint operations with law enforcement partners and during hurricane season. The majority of these radios are 16 years old, which is double their life expectancy, and they are beginning to fail. The governor also recommends approximately $683,000 in additional trust fund authority for FDLE to fill 12 positions in the Firearm Eligibility Bureau. These positions are necessary to address workload demands, keep processing times down, and reduce any backlogs. And finally, the governor's Florida LEADS budget provides the Office of the Attorney General with $109 million in additional budget authority for the Federal Victims of Crimes Act, or VOCA, grant program. The increased authority will allow the agency to distribute additional federal funds to sub-grantees to aid victims of crime. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present the Governor's Florida LEADS budget, public safety budget, and I look forward to working with you and your staff and the members of this committee as you and your staff craft the state's budget over the coming weeks. And I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And at this point, we'll take questions from members on anything we've covered so far. Vice Chair Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Secretary Marsteller. In slide six, Secretary, I didn't see mention it on the slide, but I understand there was a reduction in non-secure residential commitment of funding in the governor's recommendation.
Correct.
And I was wondering how many beds are associated with that reduction in funding?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me get that information for you. Just bear with me. I know I've got it. Hang on. I apologize. I'm going to say it's 60. Thank you. 61. Thank you. Right. So for the current year, his recommended reduction would be equate to 61 beds. And for the next fiscal year, the governor's recommendation would equate to 73 beds. I believe that is eminently reasonable. And when I do my presentation on utilization, I can go into more detail about where we are, what our utilization looks like right now, what we anticipate coming out of COVID, needing to reprocure, those kinds of issues. But what the governor is recommending here is eminently reasonable.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You recognize?
Do you believe this trend is sustainable in the future?
You recognize?
When you say trend, do you mean the trend of lowering utilization?
Yes.
I think, Representative, at this point, at the end of the day, yes. But the utilization decrease that we have seen over this last fiscal year has been substantially greater than we would have anticipated, and it has been because of COVID. The courts have not been open. Children are not being going through their adjudications. And I will show you all a slide a little bit later, where we're now starting to see an uptick again in adjudications. We anticipate that that's going to continue. We know that there is a bubble. There is going to be a bubble. We don't know what that bubble is going to look like. But in the big scheme of the way Florida's juvenile justice system is operating and the policies that have been implemented with the support of the legislature, we want to see, at the end of the day, that trend go down, yes. But the drop that we have seen this last fiscal year has been substantially greater than we would have anticipated it to be.
Thank you, Secretary. No further questions.
Thank you, Representative Learned. You're recognized, followed by Representative Rayner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is for Secretary Inge. And while you're walking up, I did my first tour inside one of your facilities last week, and your staff was, it was wonderful. Thank you for, it was very enlightening. Anybody else in the committee, I'd recommend they do it. My question is related to what the previous secretary just asked about, which is the reduction in prisoners in the system just due to COVID and lower numbers coming into the system. And I'm a business owner, and I can vary my staff pretty quickly with rises and falls in customers. And I'm curious about, in the prison system, where do we see a cost savings from prisoner reductions and likewise in the opposite direction?
Secretary Inge, you recognize?
Thank you, Representative, and thank you for coming to visit. I know the staff definitely appreciated that. Very insightful question, complex answer. We have had a reduction in inmates over since the start of COVID. Started COVID at about 93,500. And as of this morning, we're at 79,312. So 14,000. I do not have any control over my customer base. It is decided for me. But given that, the reality is where that number, changes, has gone down, and of course is predicted to make that significant move back up within 2 years, back up over 91,000. It's distributed across our system, a very complex system of 50 major complexes, plus our 7 privately managed facilities. And where one would think that, with that significance of a reduction, we'd be able to, close one specific location, shift the inmates to another location. It doesn't work that way with staff due to the geographic dispersion of our system. The staff, when I was in the military, yes, I could pick up soldiers and move them to a new location where the mission was at. We don't do that here. So what I have done, and if there's only one blessing of COVID, is this reduction of inmate population. It has allowed me to close dorms inside prisons. Not ideal. You'd never want ungoverned space inside a prison. But that has allowed me to lighten the load of staff assignments to address, unfortunately, is our vacancy rate of over, having over 3,000 correctional officers that are not, positions not filled. And then if we go back to July and August, I had over 2,000 staff that could not come to work either for having contracted COVID or at that time, the way we did screening criteria, if you had become in close contact, some of the COVID, we did not let them inside the facility. So that's that's a difference of 5,000 staff across the system. Frankly, without the courts, not by design, but reducing intakes, I'm not really sure how we would have made it through those 2 months. The actual cost figures, if we're trying to metric cost figures, it's not as easy as taking a per diem rate. Actually, we have a variable rate that is much lower than the per diem rate of an inmate. Because take one inmate out, we didn't change any duty positions. We didn't change the only variable rate, and it's not with one person, their clothing, their food, their medical treatment. It's really when you do large groups, can you actually see a change in the financial array of the department? Is that fair?
Follow up. Oh, you're done. Okay. Representative Rayner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Secretary Inge. I do have great appreciation for the work you do. My uncle is actually Secretary for the Department of Corrections for the state of Florida. So I do have great appreciation for the work that you do. I do have a question. When you're thinking about staff retention, and I know you talked a little bit about attrition, and this may come in the next part of your presentation, where does the training come for the staff? Where does that come in? Because I know sometimes that I also have owned a small business, and sometimes the training or lack thereof may make folks not want to remain. So I want to know if that figure that you gave us, does that include that as well?
You recognize?
Thank you, Representative. Laser target question. When I arrived, the way we did training, we have a dispersed way of doing training. Our academy is 34. Would do a steady start roughly every 3 months. So what would happen is you have a new correctional officer comes in, a trainee. They do receive some very immediate training, but by our policy, they could work inside our prisons, certain posts with certain expectations of supervision. For example, a supervisor coming by every hour. I didn't have a great confidence that really would happen. So think about it as a young, untrained man or woman going inside what is a very difficult environment, having only had the very minimal, absolutely required training, not the 14 weeks of our academy. So a change we made this year is we went to what's called a rolling academy. And it's not one of the top four, but it's in there. I'm using, I guess my authorities have directed over hire to do this, but I've asked for 10 full-time equivalents to do this rolling academy change. And the change of this academy means that every 2 weeks, the way we set up the academy is staff can enter every 2 weeks. So instead of having a backlog, maybe going as much to 6 months of someone going to the academy, because if for some reason they're on reserve duty, MLA, a lot of different reasons you can miss that next start. We had so many staff that it would be 6 months if they stayed 6 months that would before they would get to the academy. And so now, I mean, we are driving down the backlog of those in training. Again, it's something we can do, frankly, because of COVID, and you know, I've closed 84 dorms across our system, taking out those required so that we could pull all these trainees out of our facilities and get them into the academies. I suspect by the middle of March, we'll be down to what would be a normal backlog based on, again, the reasons of military leave, MLA, different reasons that folks are unavailable, which is roughly get it down to about 200 or 300 individuals and have all those people getting back. You know, it's kind of like the cavalry is coming, but the cavalry is in training right now. Excellent question.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mello. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Spencer.
You're recognized?
Good morning, Mr. Spencer. Thank you for all you do. My question is about VOCA Assistant Grant Program. Is the authority provided for the VOCA Assistance Grant Program funding sufficient to spend down the grant award in current and future years?
Mr. Chairman?
You recognize?
Yes, so the increase in the VOCA grant reflects the fact that there's additional funds available from the Department of Justice award to the state. The Department of Justice does routinely encourage the states to draw as much as they possibly can. And this was a request in the legislative budget request from the Attorney General's office, and the governor was happy to support that to be able to provide those additional resources to draw down and pay out to victims of crimes.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair, may I have a follow-up question?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Spencer, what is the most amount of VOCA funding the department has distributed in a given year?
You recognized?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got in front of me here three fiscal years. In fiscal year 17-18, total awards were $77.2 million. In fiscal year 18-19, total awards were $100.1 million. And in 19-20, total awards were $111.5 million. So you see an increasing trend from that. We'd be happy to go and provide some more information to you going back more years than that. Those are the three fiscal years I have in front of me.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair, I have no further follow-up.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Davis, followed by Representative DeSigley, and then Representative Byrd. Representative Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spencer, this probably is the best question for you. And would you talk to us about why was there such a large increase in the Department of Legal Affairs in the budget?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The largest increase is reflected from that increase in the budget authority for the VOCA grants.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You recognize?
So, and this next question is for Secretary Inch. Thank you, Mr. Spencer.
Secretary Inch, you are again recognized.
Thank you, Chair.
Following up with going down the line of training, I noticed for the Department of Corrections, $31.1 million was used in staff retention for your employees. Could you talk to us more about that in a little bit more in depth as to what that really is.
Yes, so I'll cover it more in the presentation I do. The largest bulk of that, if we're trying to affect environment, pay, and training, you know, we were able to do the training with the 10 FTE and just restructure our system to a rolling academy so that our correction officers are getting the full academy and fully certified before they go working in the facility, better equipping them for the environment. So the $31 million, the largest majority of that is doing the second of a three-year program to shift from a 12-hour shift to an 8.5-hour shift, and I'll give that presentation. Then the aspect of pay is last year, you know, you were all very gracious in giving a retention pay raise, which did not exist in our system. For example, if I was a sergeant with 4 years of experience and I was a sergeant with 20 years of experience, our pay is the exact same. So we put in a retention pay raise, but that pay raise was only put in as a single year. 500 for new correctional officers up to 2 years, 1,500, in other words, $1,000 difference between 2 years and 5 years, and then 2,500, again, a difference bump at the five-year point. But that was only for the year. So if you take a correctional officer that went over 2 years on the 30th of September, he got the $1,000 added to his annual pay. But the correction officer that crossed over on the 1st of October did not and does not have that. So that is why we have it in the system, is to make that retention, because it's the pay raise ahead of you that deals with retention. It's not the pay raise that came from behind. So we want to put that in place, again, at the critical point of the two-year, five-year point, where we see, you know, the end of the two-year point is when the training payback requirement finishes. So that's a period where we see staff leaving. Then 5 years, if somebody stays past 5 years, then there's a good chance they're going to stay committed for a full career. So that's why we put it in there.
One last follow-up, Chair.
You recognize?
Thank you. So going down that line, again, the next line in the presentation says safer correctional facilities. And when you were presenting that, you said this is an extensive list. And over the last couple of months, we've been dealing with hearing about reports of not so safe correctional facilities. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about what that $2.5 million is about?
You recognize.
Thank you. Very, very fair question, Representative. So in a correctional facility, we are always looking at ways to use technology, physical barriers, fence line, you know, to make actual personnel assignments as efficient and effective as possible. You know, one of the axioms out of my military days is, you know, if you're trying to slow down the enemy, an obstacle is only an obstacle if it's covered by fire. When in the correctional facility, is a security enhancement is only effective if the eyes of the staff can be brought onto it, either through technology or through the actual presence. We have control rooms with cameras. What's the good of a camera if you don't have somebody looking at the screens? So to give you kind of a longer list, I was just trying to save a little time, but different types of ways we would use that money for enhancing security, our ability to see inside our facility and along our perimeters is, there's electronic security upgrades, microwave systems at our fence lines and the like, the type of recreation tower equipment to include the visuals that come off of it, location tracking systems, intercoms for our mental health units, cell phone detectors, drone detection systems, that's a big risk, is the use of drones for the interdiction of contraband, perimeter cameras and lights, and the importance of cameras in a prison system, rapid ID for visitors, grounds maintenance equipment, body cameras, and other items. So there is no shortage of what is available in the commercial market, but that, you know, I've limited this year's request, recognizing the difficulty of general revenue. I would have asked for more in a normal year. Thank you, ma'am.
Awesome. Representative DeSigley, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Secretary Inch. for your presentation. Thank you for the work that you do in this area. It's very important. And I know you touched pretty specifically on your management of the current correction officers. Can you explain in further detail the kind of recruitment strategies that you have in order to get these future employees? Because obviously, you know, clearly there's a pretty significant, you know, need for new corrections officer. Can you touch on that strategy, please?
You recognize?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, sir. So in our recruitment, depending on where we are in the state, you know, there's a great variety of the state and what recruitment strategies work where. I'm not sure if you were 2 years ago, we changed the hiring age and statute from 19 to 18. The idea behind that, of course, was I was a military police officer in the military and had thousands of 18-year-old Floridian men and women, you know, come into the military, highly motivated to start their law enforcement career. So the idea was to take those highly motivated seniors in high school, to reach out to them and bring them in. Now, what happened was COVID, and that the schools closed and that population scattered. Have we hired 18-year-olds? Yes, we have. Had they done well? Yes, they have. But it did not have the effect that I'm hoping this year's effect will be as we go into high schools and show what a profession in corrections can be. Now, we use a variety of social media platforms to show the different types of jobs. If you go onto our website and would like to see, you know, we do spotlights on the different things, you know, be a canine handler, being a classification officer, working as an education specialist or correction officer. So we're very active in that space without giving public testimony to, you know, some websites that help link prospective employees to staff. We use them too as we work towards recruiting. And then there's always a recruiting base, which is one of the strengths of our system, is the sons and daughters of our correctional officers. Kind of a lot what I experienced in the military, that you know, sons and daughters see the good work of their mothers and fathers, of their uncles, and want to contribute that way too. And that is absolutely a recruiting pool for us.
Follow-up, please, Mr. Chair.
Quickly for a follow-up?
Very quick follow-up. Do you set specific goals per year or per quarter for new recruits?
You recognize?
Thank you. So, yes, as many as we can get. Now, the reality is recruitment isn't our current challenge. Last year, I think we recruited over 4,000. I can get you the exact numbers. Retention is our challenge. If I am losing between 46 and 47% of new employees by the 12th month, and the cost associated with every time, you know, especially if you think of what it takes to recruit, the hiring process, the training process, paying overtime for the person that's backfilling the person in training. Because I don't have it's not like the military where there's an account for people in training that isn't taken away from units in the field. We don't have that. So there's somebody working overtime to cover anybody in training, and then that person leaves. There goes about $36,000 to our system every time that happens. So my focus, frankly, is much more on the retention side, as you'll see in the 8.5-hour brief, than recruiting, because our recruiting officers are doing a very good job.
Okay, next up, Representative Byrd. You recognize that we'll be followed by Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Chairman, and while Secretary Inch, while you're up there, I just want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me offline, and you're doing a wonderful job, and thank you. Keep up the good work. But my question is actually for Mr. Spencer, so if I can have him come up.
I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Spencer, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, morning. Good to see you again. My question is about the FDLE budget. In 2020, the increase in Floridians and Americans wanting to exercise their Second Amendment right increased, and then the additional workload that puts on the Firearms Eligibility Purchase Bureau. The 12 new positions, was that the number that was given to the governor's office or recommended by FDLE?
You recognize?
Mr. Chairman, I believe, yes, that was in the governor's office. We picked that up, that recommendation from FDLE's LDR.
Great. And did you have any other discussions with FDLE that they believe that is the reason for the delay and that this will correct that problem?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It's definitely been, and I don't want to speak for FDLE. They are here, I believe. So if they wanted to add a little more on this as well. But it was definitely a surge in demand over the past year. And they were constrained by the amount of resources available from manpower, man hours, being able to process those types of applications and those requests. And so this is the request that they put forward. And they believe that this will be sufficient to be able to meet that demand.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Next up, Representative Benjamin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could
have Secretary Gaskin. Good morning, Secretary. How are you doing?
Yeah.
Great. I have a question, a follow-up question, as it relates to recruitment and retention. Along the lines of recruitment, to follow up on the representative's line of questioning, I was concerned. My question has to do with diversity. What have been your targets or your ways in which you have targeted minority communities for the department?
You recognize?
Thank you, Representative. You can imagine in our recruiting, in that our system is, you know, geographically centered, county by county, location by location. Our hiring, frankly, reflects the diversity of the community that's within the vicinity of that facility. So in terms of setting a target, you know, for a county that perhaps is an unrealistic target based on diversity, because that county, frankly, doesn't have that diversity of where the person's at. Yet, if you look at the numbers, and I can provide you, and certainly be happy to come meet with you, is, you know, you look at those locations where our facilities are in a county, in a location where the hiring pool reflects the diversity of our state, our staff reflected as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow-up?
You recognize?
As it relates to retention, do you have a breakdown based on race with regards to who you're losing with regard?
I would have to. Yes, we can. I don't know, have those figures on the top of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
We can get back with you.
Okay. Any other questions for members? Seeing none, Mr. Spencer, I want to thank you for your time today and your excellent presentation, and thank you to the governor. And we look forward to working with you on this public safety budget to provide the best situation for Floridians, in which we, I think, all agree is a very core part of our overall all budget, public safety. So, again, thank you to you and the governor and the other people here today for appearing. And next we're going to go to Secretary Inch to talk about the transition to 8.5-hour shifts. How's it going?
Thank you again, Chairman Plakin and members. So my prepared remarks are 11 minutes long prior to questions. But thank you for the opportunity. And here we are. Thank you so much. The real trick will be, can I do the right button for advancement? No, that was not it. There we go. But thank you for this opportunity, for this update on our agency's pivotal effort to improve the safety and security of our facilities. With your support, we have funded significant improvements in the last year by moving all correctional officers to 8.5-hour shifts is the linchpin of our efforts to address our agency's most significant challenges. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this effort with you. Let me start by reviewing the why of transitioning our system to 8.5-hour shifts over 3 years. Why it is so very important. Earlier, you heard me describe FTC as a system in crisis. If you want more on that, I gave about a 35-minute presentation to the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Crime and Criminal and Civil Justice on that. There are numerous statistics that describe this crisis, from staffing levels, vacancy and attrition rates, violence, contraband, and the financial burden, our personnel system, personnel turnover, and subsequent risks to the liability of our state. I shared last year a similar list of statistics when I first testified on this proposal, and frankly, most haven't gotten better since then. To be fair to all of us, the new shift schedule and pay raises did not start till just this last fall. And the pandemic added a curveball to what was already a challenging cause and effect analysis. But to mention just one statistic, our first year attrition rate has increased from 42% to over 46%. Our entire agency one-year attrition rate remains above 36%. To state the obvious, if there are not enough correctional officers to fill all the critical security posts on a given shift, much less to do the other required missions in a correctional institution, things can go very bad very quick. On any given day, on any given shift in our system, critical security posts are left unmanned for at least some period of time. Last year, fiscal year, we left critical posts unmanned for over 500,000 hours. Using calendar year, meaning pulling these last 6 months in, it has risen to 650,000 hours unmanned critical posts. This creates opportunity for individual and organized criminal activity, especially in a system that provides less than optimal opportunity for more positive choices of programs and treatment that support rehabilitation. Let me make the fact more real. Though violence levels did decrease last month over January of 2019, we are measuring it, what actually happened is nothing to be proud of. Over this past month of January, with an inmate population of about 79,500, FTC reported 260 inmate-on-inmate assaults. 40 of those were with manufactured weapons. Two instances are in investigation by FDLE for suspected homicide. These are the assaults we saw. I speculate not all the assaults that occurred. During the same month, there were 105 inmate on staff assaults, five with weapons. Let me make this even more real. On January 17th, an inmate with a life sentence used an improvised knife to attack Correctional Officer James Newman at Mayo Annex. He sustained numerous injuries, to include a laceration under his chin. This is the second time Officer Newman has been stabbed in the neck since I've become the secretary. I am personally humbled that he plans on coming back to his facility to continue to support our public safety. He is an example of the men and women we have in the Florida Department of Corrections. Each statistic is a real event of trauma, whether the victim is a staff member or an inmate. At Santa Rosa's CI on January 19th, Officer Laverne was stabbed in the chest by an inmate incarcerated with second-degree murder. At Florida State Prison on January 30th, Officer Silcox was attacked and injured by an unknown inmate while searching a mop closet outside the line of sight of a camera or the control room. He was the only officer working that dorm. And on January 26th at Northwest Florida Reception Center, Officer Ebony Green was also attacked from behind, placed in a chokehold and driven to the ground by an inmate incarcerated for sexual battery. Let's let that sink in for a second. She was also working her dorm alone. Officer Green successfully used her training to activate her body alarm and escape her attacker's hold until the eventual arrival of additional staff. But please put yourself in the shoes of our correctional officers and put yourself in the shoes of our inmates who expect to be safe in our system. To perhaps review the challenge less dramatically, to get me back on task, our attrition rate is a function of three factors: work environment, pay, and the lack of confidence by new staff that they are up to the risks and demands of the jobs, as we have discussed. Of those, work environment is critically important, and the length of shift is a critical factor in work environment. Let me explain. First, there's the sheer length of a 12-hour shift, standing. Add that working in a prison is always stressful, tense, with periodic episodes of traumatizing events. The inmate that attacked Officer Newman intended to cause grievous harm, perhaps even murder. Such is the nature of our environment, and the known risks of the profession. A correctional officer will tell you that they must be on their toes the entire shift. Some describe it as hyper-vigilant. Many of our new hires are simply unused to working with this level of intensity and rigor, much less doing it for 12 hours day after day. And it's almost never just 12 hours. By the time they do travel and required administrative work, it's 13, 14, 15 hours that can be focused on work that leaves precious little time before the correctional officer has to do it all over again the next day. As attrition settles in, the demands for mandatory overtime make the situation even tougher on our officers. It exasperates the circumstances. 12 duty hours become 16 duty hours, plus the additional travel and preparation time. At some institutions, officers are asked to regularly work 16 hours, and when they get days off, they are often called and asked to come back in and work some of those days off too. They are just tired. And it has been a downward spiral we've been experiencing for 8 years. The majority of our staff do not know what it is like to work an 8.5-hour shift with acceptable levels of overtime. The 12-hour shift affects the conduct and organization of work as well. Anyone who has ever managed shift work knows that scheduling and leading 12-hour shift rosters is extremely challenging. The requirements to manage overtime limits, equitable shift distributions, et cetera, results in a constant churn in the manning rosters. That would be bad enough on an assembly line, but in an environment where men and women are facing danger, adversity, and conflict, a cohesive team is key to success. The absence is a recipe for potential failure. Because of that churn, correctional officers are often relatively isolated, alone on a post that, in ideal situations, would have at least two officers. Even before they are on post, they often report to duty alone and with limited opportunity to be apprised of the situation they're walking into. We do not have a 12-hour shift group shift briefings. They often have little opportunity to develop rapport with their shift mates or a solid level of awareness about the dynamics of the inmates. Finally, because of the churn, the first-line supervisors, the captains and lieutenants, have great difficulty developing a team and ensuring their people meet the inmate population with shared situational understanding and a sense of cohesion. The end result of this state of affairs, of course, is that the bad actors, we have them, in the inmate population have seams and gaps they can exploit. Lack of correctional officer presence or effective presence means the things you see on the bottom half of the slide. That means a less secure, a less safe environment that encourages new correctional officers to decide this profession isn't for them and quit. And the cycle continues. If my entire professional career gives me the legitimacy to say just one thing to you, it is that we cannot sustain the cycle under a 12-hour shift. Breaking it is the point of transitioning to 8.5-hour shifts. So I laid out much of this out last year when the legislature allocated the funding to begin the transition of our institutions. With your support, we gained 220 full-time equivalents, which we used to transition a third of our facilities to 8.5-hour shifts. You see those institutions listed on the right. The 330 FTEs we are seeking this year will transition the next third and additional 17 institutions. Please recognize we have institutions of different sizes. That's how the math works. That will leave a final 16 institutions remaining for FY22-23. Continuity across the system with an 8.5-hour shift is key, though not the exclusive step, as you see from the rest of my requests, to making our prisons safer and better able to support rehabilitation and restoration of our incarcerated population to their communities, to your communities. I read that Senator Pizzo has challenged all legislators to visit two prisons this year. I support that challenge. I encourage that challenge. But let me offer one modification. Make one of those visits to a facility that has transitioned to an 8.5-hour shift and time your visit to attend the shift briefing. That means arriving at 8, 4, or 12 midnight. All are acceptable. Or an hour earlier if you're in the panhandle. You will have an opportunity to talk to the entire oncoming shift. Then watch what it looks like to see an entire shift enter the secure facility at one time. See the confidence in the team and watch them do a smooth transition with the offgoing shift. Wardens have even reported to me that staff show up early to talk with each other, to just talk. before the captain takes over the formal shift briefing. Something very powerful is happening already. When we proposed transitioning FTC back to the 8.5-hour shifts, we assessed there would be a myriad of benefits. My assessment matched both the department's experience since adopting the 12-hour shift and the findings of three separate reviews conducted by experts in the field of corrections, all three of which reviews both identified issues and operational concerns with 12-hour shifts and strongly recommended that the department return to an 8-hour model. Listed at the top of the slide, the benefits we expected from the transition included reducing the number of unmanned critical posts, the most important metric for measuring risk in the system. We expected that effect, and indeed, that's exactly what we have seen in those institutions that have transitioned, an average reduction of 91.6% in unmanned critical security posts. We expected increasing continuity of operations and effectiveness. Again, this is exactly what we've seen. The reporting from the field is unanimous, and as I have already invited each of you, if you haven't already, to visit one or more prisons that have transitioned to 8.5-hour shifts and talk to the staff. The on-the-clock shift change has just done wonders for the cohesiveness and effectiveness of the correctional staff. We've also seen more efficient and equitable assignment of overtime. How do we expect things to progress going forward? Our first institutions transitioned on September 18th. And of course, the pay raise came on October 1st. The benefits I just detailed have been immediate and very much in line with our expectations. While there is every reason to expect the reductions in the broader statistical measurements to follow, reductions in violence and criminality, allegations of abuse, staff burnout, and ultimately staff vacancies and attrition, it will take more than 4 months for the immediate improvements we've seen to have the larger second-order effects in our very complex system. Beyond just these initial indicators, we have seen already even in those areas. But I am very optimistic. And with that, Chairman Plakin and members, I thank you for having me here today. I look forward to continuing to work with each of you during this session to support our public safety mission.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We'll take any questions. Representative Rayner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Inch, there are some questions. During your presentation, you talked a lot about the fatigue and some of the mental health, I would say mental health, circumstances surrounding some of your staff members. I have a two-part question, if the chair would allow me. One, does the budget provide for therapy or any mental health resources for your staff, especially those who are still working within the 12-hour shift?
So we have that through our human resources. What's offered to all state employees, we have our employment benefit program. I can have my HR director, if you want, kind of take down all of that.
You recognize again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then additionally, when you were talking about, individuals who were on an 8.5-hour shift versus those who are on a 12-hour shift, and to Representative Davis's point, some of the things that we've been hearing in the news, are you concerned with any PTSD issues and how that affects those inmates who are currently matriculated in the prison system?
You recognize?
Thank you, Representative. I very much, being quite familiar with PTSD personally, I always worry about that. It working in a prison is an intense environment, and I think we all should be, again, humbled and grateful for those who choose that profession or any, within the array of our law enforcement profession. And we do need to recognize that the periodic episodes of trauma that I mentioned, I mean, those are real and they have a real effect. I tend to assess a lot of situations like that, using a victim's model. Probably makes sense because my wife was the senior victim assistance advisor for the Department of Defense. I get a lot of education on that. But it is trying to understand the impacts of the incidences, let alone the cumulative impact of the work schedules that our staff, it clearly has an impact. And it probably accounts for much of our attrition rate.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay. Vice Chair Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Secretary. It sounds like the 8.5 hour method has really improved things and increased your retention rate. You mentioned that on October 1st, you also had a pay increase. I was wondering, on a percentage basis, on average, what was that pay increase?
You recognize?
Thank you. Representative, so came in two ways. First, it came all state employees received a 3% pay increase, and that applied to my employees as well. There were additional pays that were given to our teaching staff in line with, of course, what happened statewide with teaching staffs as well. And then the targeted pay raises, the incentive, targeted incentive pay raise for new employees, $500, for those over 2 years, $1,500, for those over 5 years, $2,500. Of course, that was a 1 year to include the 3% is 1 year. So a correctional officer that was hired on the 1st of October is getting paid 3% less than the man or woman I hired on the 30th of September.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions from members? Representative Davis, you recognize.
Thank you, Secretary Inch. I promise to make this painless. And forgive me if you have mentioned this already. You did say that 17 of your facilities have converted to the 8.5 hour
yes,
transition. So my question to you is, do you know how many FTEs it would take to make this happen through all of your 33 facilities?
You recognize?
Thank you. So because our facilities are different sizes, we were able to use the 220, which was approximately a fourth of the number of FTE necessary to do the entire system. So this year we're asking 330 FTE. The governor is asking for 330 FTE, which will leave 330 FTE remaining for next year's ask to convert this system over a three-year time period. Even though it is more than a third of what was the total 880, it will account for this, because this will now be some larger facilities and facilities that didn't, not to confuse the whole thing, we actually had some facilities based on earlier court interaction in our facilities that provide mental health care that were, certain dorms were already on 8 hour shifts. So we took all those facilities, we just made the rest of the shifts for efficiencies. And that's what basically, even though we only got a fourth of the slots last year, we were able to do a third of the facilities. But we're still solidly and need to take advantage, frankly, of the reduced inmate population, because to allow for and facilitate this transition.
Representative Benjamin, you recognize, followed by Representative Rayner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, my question is probably quick and easy. What is the starting salary for an FTE?
You recognize?
Thank you, Representative. So starting pay for a certified correctional officer is $33,500. A trainee actually gets less. It's about $3,000 less until they finish the academy and get that certification. So starting pay $33,500. That's 16 hours. $16 an hour.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Go ahead.
And I'm just not familiar. What's the educational background required for? Thank
you. You recognize?
So for a correctional officer, it's a high school education. For a correctional probation officer, it's a bachelor's degree. And their starting pay is actually a little bit by, I think, $15 less than the start of a correctional officer.
The probation officer's
pay
is less and requires a greater
degree. At the very start, yeah. That's something we'll fix in a non-COVID year in the future. I hope.
Representative Rayner, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Secretary Inch, I do have a question. It seems, and so you may also need to correct me, it seems that I heard you say that there are going to be facilities that are going to be transitioning not this year, but in a year after the fact. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And so with those facilities that are on the last list to transition, what is the department doing to kind of to buffer some of these issues that you outlined with folks who are still on the 12-hour shift?
You recognize?
Thank you for that question. So the one lever that I can control is the number of dorms we leave open at facilities. And so we monitor very closely the vacancy rate of staff. And because right now I have the ability to close dorms, or frankly to temporarily close an entire annex, not an entire prison, but you know, half of an operation, that's the method I'm using, trying to bring down the amount of mandatory extended overtime. Do understand with our staff, there are staff who do want to do overtime, and I'm cognizant of it, and very accepting of that as long as it's done safely and the number of hours that it's safe to do it. But where for me it becomes so concerning when it's mandatory, when a young man and woman, older man and woman, was expecting to spend that day with their family, and we call and say, no, you have to come back in based on our labor agreements. Don't like doing that.
You reckon, another question, Representative Rainer? No. You're done? Okay. Any other questions for members? Seeing none, Secretary Inch, we appreciate you being here today, and also to your for your service to our country. In case members aren't aware, you came to us as a major general in the Army and has run the federal prison system, the Army prison system, and now, over the last couple of years, the Florida prison system. I kid around with friends. I think you may be overqualified for the job, but your experience in bringing corrections to this committee is very much welcome. And any individual members, he's been very accommodating to reach out and answer questions, take input, and I'll be scheduling some trips for members to visit some of the local prisons here between now and session, and y'all are welcome to come. And again, thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you, Chairman. But please know I fell on an amazing executive staff, and it took me only about 30 seconds to fall in love with the staff of the Florida Department of Corrections. They're an amazing group of people.
Well, thank you again. Okay, we're now going to go to Secretary Marstiller for an update on the residential commitment resource utilization. You are recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. I am back up to talk a little bit about our utilization in residential commitment services. And it is my pleasure to come and talk to you all about this because as we were talking a little bit earlier, COVID has had a significant impact on our utilization in residential. So I'd like to start by giving you all just a picture of where we have residential facilities across the state. We have, you'll see on this map, we've got 34 facilities, but they represent 43 programs. So that means that in some facilities, we have more than one program that we're operating. You'll also see on the left side of the slide there, the names of the 8 private providers that DJJ contracts with to operate our residential commitment programs. At DJJ, our detention centers are run directly by DJJ staff. On the residential commitment side, they are operated by private entities that we oversee very closely. We hold them accountable, as you can imagine. There are very high standards that they have to abide by to make sure that they are providing the high level of services to our youth that I would provide if I were operating those facilities. Just to give you all, a little bit of a sense of what has happened over time On this slide, you can see in 2009, we were, you know, somewhere around 5,000 beds. And over time, we are down now to where we are at a little over 1,900 beds. And a lot of that, ladies and gentlemen, is due and owing to changes in juvenile justice policy, in with the full support of the legislature, changes in the way we have shifted from funding residential services to front-end services. So prevention is a big part, a big and important part of what this agency does. With civil citation, other types of prevention programs, because as I said earlier, when we reach our children early, we keep them out of our residential commitment programs, and we're able to provide services to them in their communities. They can stay home with their families and can continue to thrive in their communities, which is really the best thing for them. The breakdown of our 1,900 beds, as you will see, 1,267 non-secure and 680 high and maximum. Those are secure. I think the nomenclature speaks for itself. Our secure programs are really for those youth who have significant delinquency backgrounds and records. Over time, as you can imagine, because we have been doing so well on the prevention side and early intervention, what has happened over time, and we expected this to happen, is that now in our residential commitment programs, we have children who have very high intensity needs, and we are able to serve them in those environments better than I think this agency has been able to do so in the past. But that's a big part of the shift in juvenile justice policy and in the way we fund the spectrum of services with the legislature's support, more work on the front end, which then leads to a smaller overall population in residential commitment. Just to give you all an idea of our per diem rates for these programs. On average, in our non-secure programs, our per diem rates are $223. In our secure programs, $247. And on average, for our intensive mental health programs, $287. Now, in all of these programs, we offer an array of services. Our programs are specialized by the services we provide, so we will have programs that are for substance abuse. We have mental health programs. We have sex offender programs. And again, intensive mental health programs. Ladies and gentlemen, just to give you all an idea, 55% of the children who come into residential commitment have some sort of mental health issue that we have to take care of first before we can deal with their criminogenic needs and to bring those factors down. Because we know that if you don't deal with the mental health issue and the substance abuse issue, the child is not going to be amenable to the full rehabilitation and getting him or her ready to be integrated back into his or her community. So I was talking about the change in juvenile justice policy and what this agency, with the legislature support, has done since 2011. The Juvenile Justice System Improvement Project was designed to make sure that we are keeping low-risk youth, by that we mean low-risk to reoffend, low-risk youth to allow them to remain in their communities and obtain services while they're in the community and in their home with minimal supervision. Again, we know from studies that youth who are placed in too intense an environment when they're at low risk tends to increase their risk of offending later. I know it might not be intuitive, but that is the case. So all of this improvement project was designed to make sure that we are treating kids and getting them rehabilitated in the proper environment. So again, moderate risk offenders placed in a structured community program with intensive probation supervision. But again, to the extent that we can keep them out of a facility, this is what we have been able to do for moderate risk. Therefore, residential placement then has been reserved for the highest risk youth after we have tried community-based alternatives and those have been exhausted. So on this slide, you all will see, the effect of the implementation now of the improvement project approaches. As I said before, the youth who are adjudicated to commitment now, much more serious and more prolific offenders. The types of bed that the legislature funded in 2013 and prior to that were general service beds. Now we have particular services and programs that are specifically designed to the needs of the individual youth. We do an individual assessment on every child pre-commitment to determine what is the best fit for him and her, for him or her, what is the best combination of services for him or her, and once the child comes into a commitment program, he or she is reassessed on a regular basis to ensure that the placement that we started with continues to be the right one. On average, in our non-secure programs, the youth stay for somewhere between 3 to 9 months. In our higher-end, more secure programs, you're looking more at 18 months stays or thereabouts. Now, this is good news. All of this really is good news. As you all will see, statewide, juvenile arrests have continued to trend down over the last several fiscal years, and we're very proud of this. We have seen, again, this fiscal year, a significant decline in juvenile arrests, and this trend was evident before the public health emergency. So we had started to see already between July 2019 and March 20, when the pandemic began, we had already seen an 8% decline in juvenile arrests. If you incorporate the numbers that we have, taking into consideration COVID, we're looking at a 17% overall decline over the last fiscal year. But we are at a 45-year low for juvenile arrests, and that trend continues to go down. Now, again, COVID has played a part in this, but as I said just now, we had already started to see a decline, and we had every indication that that decline would continue. Now, on this slide, this shows from 2009 to pretty much present day, I would say the end of calendar year 2020, what dispositions to residential commitment have looked like. With the exception of, it looks like, 2015 and 2016, when we saw a bit of an increase, we have seen decreases in residential commitment. And that makes sense. Again, because what we're doing is we are dealing with children to the extent we can in their communities, providing as many services as we can. We are doing earlier intervention, and so we are reducing the need for children to be committed to our residential facilities. Now, the last two bars that you see here show what is an unusual decrease, and that is indeed due and owing to COVID, a 28% decrease in dispositions to residential commitment. And that leads us really to this. And this is what our residential commitment services utilization looks like right now. We were talking earlier about the fact that the decline in utilization between last fiscal year and this fiscal year is much steeper than we anticipated because primarily of COVID. And that is, you know, the courts are not or hadn't been operating at full capacity. For a period of time, juvenile adjudications were completely stopped. They now are permitted to continue by video only if the parties agree to a video proceeding. Juvenile arrests are down. Children are completing their programming a lot faster than we are able to bring to place kids in commitment. So there are a lot of factors, ladies and gentlemen, that bring us to the current utilization that you see in front of you. But I do want to show you this. The bottom line, the red line, shows dispositions to residential commitment by month for the calendar year 2020. You see the steep decline after March and April, and it has begun slowly but surely to trend up, and we ended last December, again, with a bit of an uptick. So we do know that utilization is going to increase. There's no question about that. I wish I could put a number to it at this point, but we don't know what we don't know. We know that there is going to be a bubble coming through the courts. We are prepared to handle that, of course. I do not anticipate seeing our utilization go back up to levels that we have seen in past years, but I do expect it to increase, to be sure. One thing that I do want to explain or elaborate on, I know we're talking about numbers of beds, okay? But what we're really talking about is funding. And between now and, say, next fiscal year and even the fiscal year after that, the department we're going to have to reprocure several of these programs over the next several years. Many of the contracts for these programs have been in place since 2011. The cost, there's no escalation clause in those contracts, but we do know that costs to provide services have increased. We have providers who have similar staffing problems to what you just heard. They need to be able to increase the amounts that they pay to attract and retain staff. That's important to me because I want people taking care of these children who feel like they are recognized and are being paid what they are worth for the work that they are doing, which is a very important work. We also want to make sure that we are providing really the highest level of services for these children who are put in our commitment programs. That's a cost. We know that costs are going up. And so, again, I know that we're talking in terms of numbers of beds, but what we're really talking about is funding. And for me, the smart thing to do as an agency head is to make the best spending decisions that I can is to keep in mind that while our utilization is going up, our costs are also going up. And so I could say to you today, we can cut 200 beds and be fine. Well, I would have to come back to the legislature the next year to ask to get that funding back so that we can afford to purchase the services that we need for these children. So earlier we talked about the governor's recommendation. Yes, it equates to 70-something beds, you know, but it is, the dollar figure works. It is reasonable. He comprehends that we do have some unknowns. We know that we're going to have increased costs. And so he has made a recommendation that is very conservative and very reasonable and fully supported by me and my agency. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will take as many questions as you have.
Thank you. Any questions for members? You recognize?
Thank you, Chair. You indicated that arrests are down and that the high-risk residential commitment numbers are down as well. Is there a corresponding decrease in the number of juvenile offenders we're seeing in low and moderate risk placements in the community as well, or are those numbers down as well, or is that a bit of an outlier?
You recognize?
I would say those numbers are down, but I would like to get you specific numbers that we can take a look at. The department is very data rich, as you can imagine, so I can probably get that information for you before day's end.
Thank you much.
Thank you, Representative Garrison. Next up, Vice Chair Caruso.
Thank you, Secretary. I had a similar question, or maybe a follow-up to that. With the, from 2014 to 2020 years, that six-year period, it looks like arrests were down 40%, from 75,000 to 45,000. Was there a similar decrease in dropout rate from schools? And if not, what would you attribute that decrease to, other than the COVID for the last year?
You recognize?
Albert, Representative, I candidly do not know what dropout rates are or have been over this same period. There may be a correlation there, but I'd like to be able to actually look at that and research it a bit and get some information from the Department of Education on that. That is actually an interesting question. I think that is something that that both agencies should look at quite candidly.
Okay. Next up, Representative Fernandez Barquin.
Madam Secretary, I just want to say that I think you're doing a phenomenal job. We've met several times, and my door is always open to you. And just for the benefit of the committee, I wanted to ask you, what is the typical length of stay for the children in the secure and the non-secure location, so that the rest of the committee members can get an idea of how long they typically reside at these locations?
Recognize?
In our non-secure programs, 3 to 9 months typically. In our higher and high and max risk secure programs, it can be somewhere around 18 months. And we do have youth that sometime remain with us until they're 20, 21 years old.
Okay, next up, Representative Rayner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Secretary. I do have a question with regard to juvenile arrests. The decrease in numbers that you've given to us, is there also a factor in these children being direct filed? And so I know that particularly in the counties, some of the counties that I represent, we've seen the direct filing of children go up. So is there a difference in these children being arrested like as adults versus going immediately into the juvenile arrest? If you could just kind of maybe break that down for me, please.
Let's see how I can best answer your question. So when a juvenile is apprehended by law enforcement, those numbers are included in what I talked about earlier, right, with the juvenile arrest rate going down. The numbers associated with children who are direct filed, which means that they are being charged and later prosecuted as adults, those are kind of two different things. And I would be more than happy to get some actual figures for you. But when we speak at DJJ about juvenile arrests, it includes those children. And so we don't, when we speak of arrests, we don't break out later, a later decision to prosecute a young person in the adult system.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Secretary Marsteller, I want to thank you for being here today. And again, we appreciate your role in this position. I know in your background also, you've served the state in many ways over the years as Secretary of DBPR, Chief Information Officer, an endless list of Deputy General Counsel or General Counsels, and now to take on this role. And I think I could speak, I look at the jobs you and Secretary Inch do. I mean, your charges are people that have done some bad things, and you have to keep things orderly and safe. And on a good day, nothing bad happens, but sometimes something bad or very bad happens. So I think I can speak for all of us. We respect that you've taken these jobs, and which are very important in service to our state. And we look forward to working with you and Secretary Inch going forward to craft the best possible budget that we can that fulfills the objectives that you've talked about today and our committee recognizes. So as always, members, if there's any questions you have, feel free to contact staff. They're here to help in any way that you can. So with that, this will conclude our agenda today. Any further business? Seeing none, Representative Learned moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting's adjourned.